Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Gundungurra Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Wallandane Heritage Centre and Museum to officially launch our Hope Out of the Ashes exhibition and book. In particular, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Fitzsimmons, Councillor Lowry, and guest representatives from our Wallandilly Fire Brigades. We have a number of apologies, and some of those are from the brigades, the representatives, but they also include Judy Hannon, David Stinson, and Mayor Khan. They can't be here today. Well, another fire season is upon us, and thankfully the climate and the weather conditions this year are vastly different to that of 2019. Thank goodness. On Friday the 22nd of November last year, for those who don't know, Friday the 22nd of last year, a fire started at Coolong, southwest of Urandri. I don't think that ever, that just became part of Green Wattle as it advanced, but 4 days later, the Coolong fire was followed by a severe electrical storm on the Tuesday, and that was the start of the Green Wattle fire. And that went on to wreak havoc on us for the next 2 months in Wallandilly and the extended area. I'm going to hand over to Sue now to tell us why a Hope Out of the Ashes.
Well, good afternoon, Commissioner, invited guests and friends. It all started with this project about June 2019 when Peter Zanino contacted us from the Oaks Fire Brigade, asking if we had any information about the Oaks Fire Brigade so that we could start a bit of a story. And we had a look in our collection and thought, well, actually, we don't have much. We need to do something about that. So we put it on the list. And we went about our things, our other things, and my friend Helen here and I both have a bit of a library background and a research background, so we beavered away doing different things. And every Thursday we would meet and discuss our collection and solve some of the things of the world, you know, as you do. And then in November, Helen told me that her husband had been out remote firefighting in the valley, and they'd been very pleased that they were able to stop the fire that they were fighting. But not long after that, a lightning strike came, and it was in Green Wattle Creek, and that was the beginning of that fire. And one Thursday again, we were doing our work, and then suddenly a message came through on Helen's phone. The fire has jumped the valley. And that was the start of everything. The whole community suddenly mobilised, and everyone was ready to act. They didn't know what was ahead. Helen went home to Oakdale wondering what she was going to do, because that was quite close to where the fire would be coming. And I went home because I'm an Anglicare Care Disaster Relief volunteer and dusted off my uniform because I had a feeling I might need it. Then I had a call from my daughter to say, can you pick up the kids from school because the school's being closed. And so I went up and picked up my granddaughter and grandson, and my granddaughter was in kindergarten at the time, and she said, Mamma, we have to get down low and go, go, go. And so she had remembered that from preschool, and she was ready. So it just goes to show you how kids can be so resilient, isn't it, that they remember the things that they've been taught. And so that was our life for the next 6 weeks or so, wasn't it? As you would all remember, the fire from the Green Wattle Creek fire just consumed the bush and consumed property and consumed our lives. But we had that great hope from all of the fire brigades that suddenly appeared on the scene. They just appeared from everywhere to help fight that fire. And they continued to do so. And then the aircraft came, and for weeks we stopped even looking. Oh, there's another helicopter, there's another plane, because it just came as every day for so long. But thank goodness, eventually it finished, and we were able to get together again in our museum as a team and thought, we really need to start this project. And so we decided that we would do a history of firefighting in the Wallandilly area. and eventually we called it Hope Out of the Ashes because the fire brigades have given us such great hope all the way along. So we had a look at research that we could find. We had some great research that Cole Miller had done down here, and Betty Villey had done some as well. And then we interviewed people, we contacted all of the fire brigades, and some of you may have been those that we contacted. We looked through newspapers on Trove and found what things were like in the early days and gradually got some ideas together. Then, of course, we had to have a bit of a rest, didn't we, as everybody else did in the world for COVID-19. But in June, we got together again and really started in earnest with this project of Hope Out of the Ashes. And we were very fortunate that our friend John Ferguson, who is here, I'm sure, somewhere, had a fantastic collection in his shed. It was amazing, and he has been so generous in lending us a variety of things to show how firefighting has changed over time and that we could use in our exhibition, and you'll see them here when you go into the exhibition today. He also has lent us badges and so on, which I know people like to look at, especially his 60 years of service in the firefighting as a fire brigade firefighter, which is just incredible. And congratulations, John, for that great milestone. So, along with all of this research that we did, we started hearing some great stories. There were stories about before the fire brigade started over 70 years ago, when the police used to look after the fighting of fires. In the newspaper, we saw an article about a policeman in Picton who had been told that there was a fire in the Natai Valley. So he rushed, this was in about 1939, he rushed, as you can picture, not in a helicopter or in a very fast car, but somehow he rushed up to the Natai Valley to have a look to see what this fire was all about and found that it was quite advanced and that he would need help to fight it. He rushed back, in whatever form he rushed, and knocked on the doors of people in Picton and found 100 volunteers who would come and help him fight it. No training, no special outfits, no trucks, but they went out and they fought this fire and they were able to put it out, which is just amazing, just the way you people have been today and in the 2019-2020 fires. And then, of course, when fire brigades started, they started getting trucks, as you would know, and the Blitz trucks from World War II that weren't needed anymore were commandeered by quite a few of the fire brigades. They were a lovely army green, but once they became part of the fire brigade, they were painted beautiful fire engine red. And then the big sign across the side would tell you which fire brigade it was, whether it was Wilton, Oakdale, Cawdor, whatever. Well, the one at Cawdor, I believe, used to have a few problems, as some of the others probably did too. It would often break down and not make it to the fire. And there is a particular farmer at Cawdor who decided that he would follow the truck every time it went to a fire because he knew he would have to fix the truck before it got there. And when they got to the fire, quite often they would need to take out a battery from one of the farmer's trucks and put it in the Blitz so that it could pump the water, and then remember to put the battery back in the farmer's truck so that he could go home. So that's what life was like then. So we've certainly come a long way, haven't we? Then, of course, letting people know that there was a fire, sometimes it was the school bell ringing, or it might have been just by telephoning around the farmers saying that there's a fire, can some people come and help fight it? Well, when Theresa Park became had a captain, the captain had a telephone, which the council helped install, I believe. But the council would ring him every day to make sure it still worked in case it was needed to let people know there was a fire. So we've come a long way from that too, haven't we? And I must admit, doing this project, researching, and there's been quite a team in doing that, we all appreciated the firefighters, but we appreciate you even more now. It is just quite amazing how essential you are to a community. I come from a little community near Young called Kingsvale. It's just a village now. In fact, it's just a location now. And we used to be quite a thriving little community in the 50s. We had a school, no school anymore. A thriving railway station, no railway station anymore. There was a church, no church anymore. There's no general store, there's no post office, but there's a fire brigade, because the fire brigade is really needed for the orchardists and farmers in the area. And that's the case all over New South Wales, I think. There mightn't be much left in a community, but there's the fire brigade, and we're so grateful for that. So hope has come from all of those things that have happened over time. And we have a book here that you'll be able to have a look at later on. We also have another book that's called Hope Out of the Ashes for you to sign, so that you can either sign to say who you are and where you're from, or what hope means to you, so that we can spread the hope, because that's what we have for the future.
Thanks, Sue. I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to Shane Fitzsimmons, AFSM, Commissioner of Resilience, New South Wales. Shane Fitzsimmons was appointed as the inaugural Commissioner for Resilience, New South Wales, and Deputy Secretary, Emergency Management, with the Department of Premier and Cabinet from May 1, 2020. He's currently the Chair of the State Emergency Management Committee, State Recovery Committee, and the National Emergency Medical Committee. This appointment followed a distinguished career with the New South Wales Rural Fire Service of over 35 years, serving as both a volunteer and a salaried member. In 1998, he was appointed an Assistant Commissioner with the RFS and has held portfolio responsibilities for operations, strategic development, and regional management. In 2004, he was appointed the inaugural Australasian Fire Authorities Council Visiting Fellow to the Australian Institute of Police Management for a period of 12 months, developing and delivering programs in management and leadership. During the period of September 2007 to April 2020, he was the Commissioner of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service, and was also the Chair of the New South Wales RFS Bushfire Coordinating Committee and the Rural Fire Service Advisory Council. He was also a member of the New South Wales State Emergency Management Committee and the New South Wales State Rescue Board, and was Chair of the State Rescue Board from 2008 to November 2015. In July 2012, he was appointed a board member of the New South Wales Government Telecommunications Authority. He was appointed a director of the National Aerial Firefighting Centre in March of 2008 and was the chair of the NASC board from 2009 to 2013. He was a director on the Bushfire Cooperative Research Centre from 2009 to 2014 and a member of the Australasian Fire and Emergency Services Authority Council from 2007, and a member of its board from November 2016 to November 2019, and held the position of Deputy President upon retirement from the board. Commissioner Fitzsimmons has been awarded the Rural Fire Service Long Service Medal for more than 30 years, the National Medal in recognition of more than 35 years, and the Australian Fire Service Medal. In January 2016, he was appointed as Counsellor of the Royal Humane Society of New South Wales Incorporated. Additionally, he is a patron of two charities, Kids Express and Coffee for Kids. He has also been acknowledged with a Paul Harris Fellow and a Paul Harris Fellow Sapphire through Rotary Clubs of Barara and Sydney. He has most recently been announced as the 2021 New South Wales Australian of the Year and the Australian Father of the Year 2020 through the Shepherd Centre. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Trish, and good afternoon, everybody. It is absolutely an honour to be invited down today and to witness and ultimately catch up with people and reflect on the enormity of what's happened and what's continuing to happen and what's achieved throughout this district. Over many decades. But can I acknowledge Trish, Sue, Ben, Doreen, and all the team with the Wallandilly Heritage Centre? Can I acknowledge Councillor Lowry? And most importantly, members and representatives of the local Rural Fire Service and communities right throughout this area. As Sue was reflecting there and just going back through time in the formation and foundation of the Rural Fire Service as we know it today, but the old bushfire brigades and bushfire fighting more generally here throughout the Wallandilly district, it cast my mind back to the work that we did in the service where we identified the first available records for the foundation of the bushfire brigade movement here in New South Wales, and it dates back to 1901, a little place called Berrigan, down on the southern border near the Murray River, not too far from Albury. And since 1901, when those records were identified, right through to today, as Sue has indicated, the foundation of that organisation has been the willingness and the generosity of men and women that sign themselves up to simply make a difference in their local community. And make a difference they have done and make a difference they continue to do in communities far and wide. And it's that expertise, it's that commitment that we've seen evolve and develop over the decades. And I know John was singled out and he's been serving for over 50 years, over 60 years. They obviously signed him up at kindergarten because he's not that old. But when I look at people like John and so many others that have provided a lifetime of service, and reflecting on what Sue's talked about with the very early rudimentary equipment and techniques and you know, state of the art Blitz wagons that they were getting hold of. And I remember when I joined, we had just moved our Blitz wagon on, but we still had some old Bedfords and some old AB-160s and those sorts of things. And without an exaggeration, you had a good day, as Sue indicated, if you turned up at that fire shed and the truck actually started. It was an even better day if you put it in first gear and she went forward. And you knew you knew you were onto something if you put the foot on the brake and the thing stopped. And then as Sue indicated, when you actually got to the fire, the hope that pump would fire up and water would come out the end of your hose line was also, you know, something that you were really thankful for. And I remember when I first left school, I became a motor mechanic by trade, and we literally, weekend after weekend and weeknights, we would pull those trucks apart and we would try to get them so that they were operational. There's no way I would even come close to saying they were roadworthy, but at least they were operational, they were drivable, and crews were just hanging off the back of them. They'd stand up on the backs of trays. The OH&S regime that we take for granted today simply just wasn't contemplated to that order back then. The thing that always fascinated me was I never understood why we put sirens on them and flashing lights, because the minute you hit an incline, you were back to first gear, and the cyclists would literally go around you on their push bikes. But going down the other side, you used to get a bit of momentum, and you just hoped nothing would pull out in front of you going down the hills as you journeyed up the other side. But no matter that variation, and when we think back to the rudimentary equipment, and we reflect on some of the images and the materials that are captured in here in this wonderful display, paying tribute to people, you look at how basic and simple the equipment was, and you know that over the years and over the decades, we've seen councils come together, we've seen governments come together, and we've seen communities come together to invest in improving what it is that firefighters were relying on and needing to utilise to provide the very best services and protection they could to their local community. And in paying tribute today, as Sue and Trish have said, we have to pay tribute to our members and those that have gone before them, because it was their tenacity, it was their commitment, like we see modelled in the volunteer culture and the volunteer spirit today. It was that tenacity and that commitment and that perseverance to keep lobbying, to keep arguing, to keep representing the need for betterment, the need for improvement. And when we look around today, and I see new members joining up the organisation in the modern era, they just take for granted how advanced, how modern how sophisticated the technologies are, the equipment is, and the and you know what, they deserve it. They expect it, and it should be the way we do it. But you've only got to go back a few decades, and you realise how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. I think the other thing that I keep reminding myself of, and as I reflect certainly on the traumatic events, the tragic events of the 1920 fire season, is that professionalism is not about whether you're paid for what you do. Professionalism is about what you do it and how you do it. So if we can equip our volunteers with the best training and skill standards that are available and nationally and internationally recognised, if we can equip them with the best trucks and firefighting equipment and support them with technology and systems and programs and platforms and the very best of legislation arrangements and protection arrangements and the support that's necessary when they're doing their job, then we've seen on display over and over again over the decades, but certainly for the world to witness in our adversity last year, professionalism was second to none. Our volunteers are recognised and regarded around the world for their extraordinary capacity, their expertise, their skills when it comes to delivering for the people of New South Wales. And I don't say that lightly, because in my time with the organisation over many decades, and particularly in the last 12 years as Commissioner of the organisation, I've had the benefit of connecting with people around the world, connecting with people around Australia, and there is reach across the world where people come and visit this state, and we've seen the return where they've wanted to emulate the Rural Fire Service. They want to understand what it is, how it operates, how it functions, so they can go back to their jurisdiction, whether it's domestically or much further afield, to try and emulate that community-based, professional, volunteer firefighting organisation. So you are recognised and regarded as extraordinary individuals, as an extraordinary team, not just here in the local Wallandilly district and close by, but right around this great state, right around this great country, and right around the world. To this day, I will never forget a number of overseas deployments. Botswana government came to New South Wales and said, we want to create our own Botswana Rural Fire Service. We sent people over to Botswana to train and develop under an AusAid program. And I think we sent over something like 100 volunteers over a couple of year period. And so many of those volunteers had never had a passport, let alone left our shores. And here they were over in Botswana training villagers and individuals in villages in everything from basic firefighting technique to crew leader to fire investigation to command and control arrangements, etc., etc. And only in recent years, with the amount of people geared up and our offloading of some old surplus firefighting equipment, protective clothing, and indeed fire trucks, they've established the Botswana Rural Fire Service that's working in partnership with the Forestry Range Reserve Management services over in Botswana. I also remind myself that in the last few years we've been sending firefighters and incident management personnel to places like Canada and the United States on a very regular basis, over a decade now or more of sending that support, probably closer to 20 years actually, the early 2000s when we first started. But what's interesting is over in those other jurisdictions, particularly in the wildfire firefighting as they call it, it's the domain of paid people. They don't actually have volunteers doing the bushfire fighting or the wildfire fighting. They've got volunteers that look after villages and towns and counties and what have you. And when they put a special request in for incident management people, et cetera, et cetera, and then they wanted a whole range of specialist remote area firefighters, and Wallandilly is renowned for having a good remote area firefighting need and capacity. And we identified whatever it was, 100 firefighters, whatever the number was, it was immaterial. And they were all geared up, they did the passport checks, all their clearance checks, et cetera, and they were getting ready to get on the flights and head over to Canada and the United States. And the message came back from the national liaison that said, oh, hold on, we've got a problem. All the crews coming from New South Wales are volunteers. We over in the United States and particularly Canada, we can't accept volunteers on our fire ground, let alone leading specialist roles or incident command roles. And I sat there in the good old Aussie spirit and said, well, you know, stuff them. They wanted this skill set. They wanted the experience and the competencies that listed all these things. We've got them in spades. They just happen to be volunteers. So in the good old Aussie initiative, we said to the volunteers, when you land in Canada, you're going to go on a daily rate. It's going to be a per diem rate where we're going to pay you. And everyone you talk to when you're over in Canada, you can let them know you're paid members of the Rural Fire Service from New South Wales. But we also said, don't get used to it, because when you get back on the plane, you go home. But why do I tell that story? Because it just reinforces the folly of not recognising the professionalism, that skills and competencies are not tied with whether you're paid for delivering that service or that capability or not. So when I reflect on and have a quick wander around this facility, I'm just in awe of how far we've come in a relatively short period of time. But we've only done it because we've got men and women that dedicate themselves day in, day out, year in, year out, decade on decade on decade, to give and serve their local community. I can't let today pass without reflecting on the enormity of last season, and everybody here, the thoughts would be very raw, and as Sue indicated, we are only days away from some pretty significant anniversary milestones in this part of New South Wales as we turn the corner in the coming weeks. But if I reflect on just this month alone, this time last year, what an extraordinary difference we were having. And it was a build-up of a year like we've never seen before. A lot of people don't realise that the outlook for the 1920 fire season, even though it showed a lot of the Great Dividing Range as expecting above normal fire conditions, the same outlook, indeed even worse geographically, was signalled for the year before. We just didn't get the weather elements and the number of fires that lined up, and we had the relief. We had some relief with weather. But as we came into this season, on the back of an intensifying drought, where 100% of New South Wales was drought declared or drought affected, we started seeing fires up in northern New South Wales averaging more than 1,000 fires a month during winter. June, July and August, over 1,000 fires a month. And then as we moved into spring and into summer, the numbers just intensified. And as we got into months like November, we were up over 2,000 fires for the month across the state. And the resultant damage and destruction and despair and tragedy were all in those figures. You know, just under 2,500 homes, 5.5 million hectares, 26 lives lost, 2 lives lost in October, 7 lives lost in November, 5 lives lost in December, and 12 lives lost in January. Sadly, in those 26 lives, as sad as that is, we lost 7 firefighters. We lost 4 volunteers in the month of December. On the 19th of December, not too far from here, obviously, where Andrew and Jeff were killed in that accident. Then only on the 30th of December, we saw young Sam lose his life down near the Victorian border. Then on the day after, on the 31st, as it turned out, with the benefit of a follow-up investigation, Cole passed away down in a little place called Ballara, down in the southern southeast corner of the state, up in the back end of the ranges. And then when we didn't think the season could get any worse in terms of that toll on our workforce, on the 23rd of January, we saw the large water bombing aeroplane crash down in the high country down near Cooma, killing all 3 people on board, Ian, Paul and Rick. It's a season like we've never experienced before in New South Wales. It was unprecedented for a reason. There was a lot of people, commentators out there, that didn't like me using the word unprecedented. But what I would say to anybody is, if we haven't seen it before, if we haven't seen the sorts of weather conditions before, if we haven't seen the landscape conditions before, if we haven't seen the fire behaviour and the fire spread like it before, if we haven't seen the resultant damage and destruction and despair like we've seen before, if we haven't seen the loss of life before, then what is the word if it's not unprecedented? I don't know what it is, but it is unprecedented for New South Wales. I don't take away at all from the tragedy of Black Saturday in Victoria, where in one afternoon 173 people were killed. But for New South Wales, we've never seen anything like it. But under the backdrop of such adversity, under the backdrop of such damage and destruction and tragedy, what we also saw, and we continue to see, is a remarkable outpouring of the human spirit. We saw a connectedness across communities. We're still seeing that connectedness across communities. We saw an outpouring of care and compassion, of support and of love that was coming out in all manifestations, whether it was people opening their doors to provide a room for the night or a couple of weeks because they'd lost everything, whether it was people supplying goods and materials to evacuation centres or relief centres, whether it was transporting all manner of things, it didn't matter what it was, whether it was helping out with the rebuild and the repair, or indeed the extraordinary generosity through donated funds that were going out into communities to help with that rebuilding, that repair, that recovery and the healing. It was quite remarkable. So if ever you wanted to be reminded of the extraordinary culture, of the extraordinary societies that we have in communities right across New South Wales, right across Australia, and in places like Wallandilly, you've only got to reflect on the adversity and see how so much goodwill ultimately triumphs in terms of helping everyone through on that journey. And at the heart of that are our volunteers. It's the volunteers like the Heritage Centre here. It's the volunteers like our men and women on the front line with the Rural Fire Service. It's community organisation. It's the not-for-profit groups that all come together to help weave that really important social fabric that ties us all together to help us through these very, very difficult and uncertain times. For a lot of our communities, the bushfires were an awful blow on the back of what already was a debilitating drought. In a lot of those same areas, we saw storms and floods as we moved into February, washing away the denuded landscape and having all sorts of other challenges to those that were already affected by droughts and bushfires. And then, of course, with the turning into 2020, no one's immune from the challenges associated with managing a response to and dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. So when you talk about resilience, when you talk about hope, when you talk about a way forward, then I think, and I pay tribute to the team here at the Heritage Centre, to Trish and Sue and all the team, exhibitions like this, publications like Hope Out of the Ashes, they matter. They capture memories, they provide reflections, and our job is to make sure, particularly when we reflect on the enormity of loss, the enormity of damage, and indeed the loss of life and what that means to so many families, so many organisations, so many brigades, is that we remind everybody that there is hope. Whilst ever we are here, whilst ever we are connecting and linking up with our local communities, there is hope. And in my new role, in the role of Resilience New South Wales, the three big priorities that the Premier and the Minister assigned were recovery, recovery, recovery. And that remains the three big priorities today. We've got an investment program going across New South Wales like we've never seen before. Over $4 billion in bushfire recovery alone, let alone everything that's coming in to match up with the COVID and related re-energising and recovery investments. But what we're finding across 40 local government areas, from the Queensland border all the way down to the Victorian border in the bushfire recovery effort, is that whilst the programs are designed to support everybody at the local level, everyone's needs, everyone's priorities, everyone's circumstances are slightly different. So what matters as a priority in one area is not the priority in another area. So our ability to make sure we've got the tailoring and the nuance and the flexibility to lead with those local community-led priorities and those community-led efforts is really encouraging, and to see us with the Commonwealth moving that policy framework to accommodate those local variances really matters to help providing that hope, to help providing that certainty, and most importantly, help people on the recovery, the rebuilding, the repair, and importantly, the emotional and psychological healing and repair that's necessary across the state. I will just finish by saying one thing. It was a tough season on so many levels, and like everybody in New South Wales, I was broken emotionally many, many times, and particularly when it came to some of those darkest of days. Like everybody, when we thought we were gaining the upper hand, we were all deflated. I think Sue mentioned we might be gaining the upper hand. We across the state, we might be down to 40 or 50 fires, and we thought, oh, there's a bit of a window of opportunity here. But then in an afternoon, another lightning storm band would come across, and in 12 hours, we'd be back to 160, 175 fires all burning and running. They were really challenging times. But I think one of the most concerning phone calls or conversations I've had in recent months was a conversation not too long ago to a former RFS colleague, still friend and colleague to this day. It was late at night driving home from the office, and it was a conversation reflecting on some challenging times through the season. And it was an emotional conversation. There was a few tears on either end of the phone. But what he said to me was, "I'm getting better." And I said, "That's good to hear." I said, "It sounds like it, mate." And he said, "Yeah, no." He said, "I'm talking to someone. I'm more open about what's happening and how I'm feeling. I'm getting some professional support, and it's really helping me. It's helping me much more with my wife and the kids. It's helping me with my colleagues and friends in the community." And I said, "Well, mate, I'm really proud of you. That's really good to hear." And he said, "No, thanks for that." And I said, "Well, you keep going, won't you?" And he said, "Yeah, I will." And he said, "But before you go, you've got to promise me something." I said, "What's that?" He said, "You cannot tell anyone that I'm getting help." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I don't want anyone to judge me." He said, "I don't want anyone to think that I'm not coping, that I'm not up to this. I don't want anyone to think lesser of me because I'm actually getting some support or some assistance." And it's the thing that's disturbed me the most out of the entire season. And without being too stereotypical and without being too sexist, but based on my own experience, this male macho BS culture that blokes carry across this state, across this country, we've got to shift it. We've actually got to have the conversation that says, with what we've been experiencing, with what we've seen, it's okay not to be okay. It's okay to shed a tear. It's okay to be concerned about how your family's going, how you're going to put food on the table, how you're going to pay the bills. It's actually okay to do those sorts of things, feel that so way. But more importantly, it's okay to share with your colleagues, because we know over and over again that peer review, peer support, peer assistance is one of the most powerful things that gets us through. It's not blokes exclusively. We're all in this together, men and women, young, middle-aged, more senior. We are all in this together. And the more we can normalise conversations around thoughts and feelings and how we can help each other and look out for each other, get through these difficult times, the better off and the stronger we're all going to be. But in picking up on the theme out of today, which the Heritage team have really beautifully put together, it gives us all hope, because it reminds us that what we're feeling, what we're doing, if it's different to everybody else, it's still okay. If I'm going okay, but someone else is not, that's okay too. The irony is, if Sue and I went in for shoulder operations and we got our shoulders fixed up in the same week, and Sue's up and running and she's bowling a good arm down the club in a couple of weeks, but I'm still going in and seeing my physio for the next 6 weeks because mine just isn't repairing right, no one will think anything of me. So why is it that we can't have that same conversation and explain what we're doing and how we're doing it and how we're getting on when it comes to the way we think and feel, particularly after really difficult, traumatic and overwhelming events? But in New South Wales' case, in Australia's case, the world's case, but certainly in New South Wales, events that have been compounding over the last couple of years, droughts, bushfires, storms and floods, COVID, it's all been affecting, for some areas, those communities have had all four of those things landing on their plate. For some areas, they might only have one or two. It doesn't matter. It's all about providing hope and providing certainty. And internally, as individuals, as families, as communities, as brigades, as volunteer organisations, the more we can provide that connectedness, more that we can provide that conversation, we actually build that resilience in communities, because we know together, if we work on things, we can actually achieve really good results. So thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. Thank you again, particularly to our volunteers. Sue and Trish wanted me to single you out again today. The love and support and respect that you have throughout communities locally here and much further afield is something that you should be very proud of. I know you'll be humble about it, but you deserve to be very proud, because they know that what you do and what you achieve makes a difference in their world, makes a difference in their community. And whilst we can't succeed all the time, whilst there are losses, while there is damage, we know that without the individual and collective efforts, the results and the damage and the destruction would have been considerably worse. As a matter of fact, leading into the last season, the independent evaluations we've seen, as tragic as 26 lives lost was, the expected result was up over 200, given the concentration of damage. So never underestimate your individual and collective efforts. And to Sue and Trish, it is an absolute honour to be here today to officially launch the opening of the Hope Out of the Ashes exhibition here, but also importantly, the Hope Out of the Ashes book, that's been so beautifully put together, capturing very nicely the exhibition that you've got on display here in the building. Thank you very much. Keep going, keep working. What a wonderful community, what a wonderful place Wallumbilly is and the Oaks is, and together we will eventually come out of all of this better and stronger and thriving as local communities once again. Thank you very much for the invitation to join you.